The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
We're on the home stretch. And this last panel we have is one that focuses on perhaps the biggest news of the last year, which is the issuance of the Open Government Directive. We've talked about the Holder FOIA Memorandum. We've talked about OGIS. We've talked about the Executive Order on National Security. Well, now we're talking about the mother of all transparency initiatives, the one that started back on January 21st, just about a year ago today, and then advanced forward with the Open Government Directive that was issued in early December. And we've gathered together here a group of really good experts to speak to that and to answer your questions as well. And a good stretch of time that we have, we'll have at least an hour and a half or so before we then have our reception immediately afterwards. And as I've said earlier, what we do is we put a lot of detail in the biographical information that's in your handout packages, so there's no need to repeat that here in order to save time and deliver more content to you. I'll just introduce our moderator, who will then introduce the other folks as they go along. And actually, our moderator is someone who really doesn't need much of an introduction, although that's an old cliche. Sometimes it can happen to be true, and it happens to be true in this case, because Gary Bass is one of the grand old men, if not the grand old man of transparency in general, as recently solidified by the role that he played in the 21st Century Right to Know, a project that led to dozens and dozens of recommendations being made to the Obama administration regarding transparency matters far in advance. And it's very nice that when you can see your recommendations coming into fruition, as Gary has been able to do in a number of instances. He's executive director and founder of OMB Watch. He holds a PhD. His brother is the provost of this university, although you won't find that necessarily in his bio. And he also, speaking of this university, is a member of the board, advisory board of the Collaboration on Government Secrecy. So let me then just turn you over to the very capable hands of Dr. Gary Bass.
I'm not sure that being the grand old anything is the right approach to start. I have been involved in transparency issues for a number of years. Some of you in the room I know, and we work together on lots of issues. Probably about a year ago, I was here at a different conference sponsored by Dan and CGS, and I talked about, with the incoming Obama administration, the opportunity for undergoing a transformational change in openness. And I also warned at that time that such transformational changes take time, and that it is much more than simply a directive. It is much more than just employing 21st century technology tools, although both are needed. It is also really about cultural change, the way government operates. And this directive, the Open Government Directive, which for our purposes of panel, we all probably will talk about it as OGD just to save time. The OGD is a step in the direction of addressing policy, technology, and that cultural change. It's an exciting effort. As you'll hear from Sean Moulton, who works at OMB Watch and one of the panelists, he'll talk about this in terms of the recommendations that Dan was referring to that we gave to the incoming Obama administration calling for a directive. So he may have some things to say about whether he got precisely what he wanted and what many in the public interest community were calling for. Alex Hunt, who is with the administration and works at OMB, and I'll describe each of the panelists a little bit more, will help us start this panel off by describing the actual content of the OGD and how we got there, all the way from the first day of the administration, the Obama administration. We'll then follow it after Sean and Alex. We'll go to Clint Hendler, who is a journalist, and I'll describe him in a minute. And he will talk about this from a journalist point of view, as well as specifically looking at even though much of the other panels have focused on FOIA, Freedom of the Information Act. He will talk a little bit about the thirst of journalists of using FOIA and how and whether OGD is going to make much impact on that front. And we will finalize or conclude the panel with Bert Wides, who comes to us with extraordinary experience of working in government, and I will also describe his role. What he will do is help talk about OGD in the broader context of transparency, and also talk about, with all these kinds of directives, the key is going to be implementation. So it's an exciting panel. We will keep our comments short in order to invite interaction with those of you here, I'm excited about that. Let me just say a few words about the panelists themselves, who I know most of these panelists quite well and have worked with them, and can tell you that you will get cogent, if not clear and precise information from each of them, from each of their perspectives. Alex Hunt is the Information Policy Branch Chief at the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, which is in OMB, and actually oversees much of the policies that deal with the OGD and other aspects to information dissemination and information policy. He has worked at OMB for a few years. Before being the branch chief, one of his main areas had to do with regulatory issues. So he cuts across information policy and regulatory. And by the way, his personal background and specialty area, and he still deals with it in his professional role, deals with international issues. So he has quite an array of knowledge to bring to the table. Sean Moulton is the Director of Information Policy at OMB Watch and has been there for a number of years, just after the takedown of information post 9/11, and is nationally known as a right-to-know advocate. I would say that some of his highlights, he is both a policy and a technology kind of guy. He co-directed the FedSpending.org effort, which was the effort to create a website of all government spending that became the background for USAspending.gov, which was, for those of you who are really following this stuff, that's what then-Senator Obama created as legislation with Senator Tom Coburn that now the now Obama administration needs to implement. Sean's also been involved in environmental information. In fact, I would say that's his specialty area beyond general right to know. He comes out of the environmental background. He used to work at Friends of the Earth. He worked at EPA. He worked at some other organizations dealing with environmental research. Third person, Clint Hendler. Clint, I think I first saw your name when you were dealing with the NewsHour, Tim Lehrer. Clint has written extensively, been published in numerous publications from Mother Jones to the New York Times, range of other publications. He's now with Columbia Journalism Review and has the beat on public access. And that's pretty unusual in the journalism field, and that's a credit to CJR to have created a beat to track issues around government transparency. So he's the guy. And there's probably very, very handful of journalists who know as much as he does about the transparency world in government. And then wrapping up, we have Bert Wides. Bert is 45 years of government service and private sector service. He goes back to the days of the Carter administration, dealing with intelligence issues there and writing numerous documents and has worked on the Hill for many members of Congress, including Senators Phil Hart, Paul Sarbanes, Ted Kennedy. He's worked on the House side for John Conyers. More recently, he had his hand in the legislation that's been talked about today dealing with state secrets. So he's been touching on lots of related issues. With that, my hardest job, which was to get the bios right, I have now hit the ball out of the park and turn to the players. Alex, you're first up.
coach. And thank you to AU for hosting this conference. It's great as we at OMB and in the agencies are in the midst of meeting some very tight deadlines in the OMB OGD to pause and reflect back on a year of work, which what I'm hoping I'll be able to convey reflects a lot of hard work and accomplishments, but it's really just the beginning of a lot more work in the future and hopefully a lot more benefits in terms of improving the way the federal government engages with the public and provides information and accountability about what we are up to. So this all began a year ago tomorrow on January 21st, 2009, when President Obama issued his memorandum to agencies on transparency and open government. And what this memorandum embodied were a number of ideas that he's discussed, and they include, first, accessing the widely dispersed information throughout the country, that's acknowledging that Washington doesn't have all the answers, that individuals and NGOs throughout the country have a lot of information and ideas that would benefit the government in our policy development. Secondly, we want to make government information accessible and readily accessible so that the public can find and use information that helps them in their daily lives and also helps agencies achieve programmatic missions. And finally is the idea that sunlight is the best disinfectant, quoting Justice Brandeis. And there we're talking about information disseminations that make agencies accountable for using taxpayer dollars wisely and ethically. The other main thing the memorandum did was direct a process, starting with the development of recommendations by the Chief Technology Officer in the Office of Science and Technology Policy for a open government directive to be issued by the director of OMB. And what the CTO did was launch in May an open government initiative, which was a very ambitious, novel online public engagement using Web 2.0 tools such as blogs and wikis and a digital town hall to tee up issues and solicit public comments and ideas. And we received thousands of ideas that fed into the development of recommendations that were in turn submitted to OMB. And I've listed some of the more notable suggestions we received from the public that influenced the directive that we issued. And these ideas included seeking public input on the data that government disseminates, identifying agencies and pilot programs to test out some of these ideas to improve transparency, participation, and collaboration, and posting frequently requested categories information so that you don't have to submit a FOIA request and have FOIAs be the last resort and not the first resort when the public seeks information about what the government is doing. So this open government initiative led to the much anticipated December 8, 2009 OMB Open Government Directive. And the directive is split up into four major sections that deal with the four overarching goals. The first is calling on agencies to disseminate government information to the public online using open, searchable, downloadable formats. Second is improving the quality of information available to the public, and there the focus is on financial information to ensure that it's accurate, timely, and comprehensive. Third, the directive seeks to instill the culture change that Gary mentioned, and instilling the three principles the president outlined through the development and issuance of agency open government plans and open government web pages on their websites. And finally, my office within OMB, the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, was tasked with the review of government-wide information policies and OMB guidance to agencies to help facilitate agency implementation of the Open Government Directive. So next, let me mention a few of the key milestones in the directive that we are focused on at the moment and need to focus on after this week. This Friday, the 22nd, is an important day in that three milestones are due. First, agencies must post on data.gov three high-value data sets. And by high-value, we mean data sets that either advance an agency mission or objective or provide useful information to the public. So as an example, the USDA has disseminated data on the 1,000 most commonly consumed foods with the nutritional information. The second deliverable we have due on Friday is the creation of an interagency working group to oversee implementation of the directive. And this task is complete. This group has met twice, and we're meeting again this week. And I would say that this group is notable in that we have very senior-level participation, and this is these aren't necessarily the CIOs in the agencies. These are people in the front offices, chiefs of staff, for example, who are focused on not just the technology, but the policies that need to be reviewed. And we would emphasize that this whole initiative is not so much a technology initiative, but a policy initiative. And the meetings we've had have demonstrated the enthusiasm for this directive, which, as someone who's been at OMB for quite a while, I would say is notable. It's not the typical response we get to OMB directives to agencies. Here, there's been, again, high-level involvement and a sense that agencies want to perform. They want to rise to the top, and there's even a bit of healthy competition that's happening as we discuss what agencies are going to be posting on data.gov. And the third task is on track, which is identifying senior agency accountable officials who will focus on the quality of federal spending information. So after this week, a couple of milestones that we're focusing on. One is due on February 6th, and this is the creation on each agency's website, an open government web page, which will be a way for the agency to tell the public what it's doing to implement the directive and seek public comment on, for example, a draft open government plan or data sets to be posted on data.gov. And then on April 7th, all agency open government plans are due. And here the plans are very extensive. The directive had an appendix that listed out all the items to be addressed in the plans. And if you go through that, you'll see that it is not just technology-driven, that we are forcing agencies to rethink how they collect, use, and disseminate information that affects the underlying policies for which they're responsible. So let me turn to something that OIRA is responsible for, and what I mentioned is the fourth main goal of the directive, which is a review of information policies and other OMB guidance that affect the way agencies respond to the directive and interact with the public in new ways, which is what we're trying to encourage. One issue is the Paperwork Reduction Act, which is near and dear to the hearts of us in OIRA. This is the act that created our office in 1980 and sets the basic framework for the federal government's collection, use, and dissemination of information, and calls on OMB and the agencies, when agencies collect information, to strike the appropriate balance between the burden imposed on the public of collecting that information and the usefulness of that information to agencies in their performance of their missions. So what we did in October was publish a notice in the Federal Register seeking public comment. And we asked them to focus on a few specific things. First, as always, we're interested in ideas to reduce the paperwork burdens imposed on the public and give suggestions on how we can improve the usefulness, the practical utility of the information collected by agencies. Second, we want to do a better job of estimating the time and money devoted by the public to responding to information collection requests, maintaining records, and making third-party disclosures so that we have a more accurate, sensitive, complete metric for the burden imposed on the public. And we asked the public for ideas on how agents, or how OMB could, in its review of information collection requests from agencies, to deal with mandatory versus voluntary collections, and how those two different types of collections can be dealt with differently due to the different nature of a mandatory versus a voluntary collection. We received over 100 comments, most of which were from the public, but we got comments from agency officials as well. Another issue that I'm sure most of you here are familiar with are cookies or web-based tracking technologies. OMB is taking a long, hard look at a decade-old policy that's a de facto ban on the use of persistent cookies on agency websites. They're now only allowed when the head of an agency finds a compelling need. Now, of course, since OMB's guidance in 2000, the way people use websites has changed dramatically. We didn't have Amazon.com back then, and this in turn has changed the way in which the public interacts with the public with the government online. So we are reviewing that policy to see what we can do to allow agencies to make use of these technologies that make visiting a website a more user-friendly experience. There's a lot you can do once these technologies are used. But IRS.gov is not Amazon.com, and we realize that there are serious privacy concerns with the use of this technology. So, again, we've started a public comment process. We've met with outside groups and internally within government to develop new ideas and a new approach that will, I think, there are no final decisions yet, adopt a risk-based approach so that depending on the particular use of a tracking technology, whether it's a persistent cookie or not, or involves the use of a third-party website, there will be different levels of notice and oversight. But we are still reviewing the comments and the input we've received and deciding on next steps with respect to our cookies policy. So with that, I will conclude, but I look forward to answering any questions you may have. Thank you.
Thanks, Alex. Sean Moulton will be next, and let me say that since he was just talking about cookie policy, I promise to buy someone a cookie for the best question that comes to the panel later, and maybe the most frequent questions. So start writing your questions down. Sean, you're up.
Thank you for having me, first off. But as mentioned in the introduction, I had the honor of helping to shepherd along a very large and long project called the 21st Century Right to Know Project, which worked with more than 100 groups across the country from across the political spectrum to develop what turned out to be 70 specific recommendations for the next administration, whoever that was going to be. The majority of the project took place before the elections. In fact, the majority of the project took place before we knew who the candidates even were going to be. And the reality was that there was an incredible interest out there by the public interest sector to get a change. And they knew that with a new administration, whoever it was going to be, that there was going to be an opportunity to make a case for a more open government. So these recommendations, they range from very specific on sort of a national security front, which the last panel was talking quite a bit about, the classification executive order, to very high tech, electronic records management, along the lines of the cookies policy, to more cultural. And really, the way we talked about it were three different changes we wanted to get out of government: a policy change, a technology change, and a cultural change. And in a lot of ways, that's also the increasing order of difficulty for government. It's easy to get the policy change if the administration wants the policy change. It's a little bit more resource intensive to try and get the technology change to invest in that. But then the cultural change is the one that's much harder to get, much longer term effort. It takes a lot more leadership, a lot more energy than the other two. And the Open Government Directive, I have to say, meets a lot of those criteria. And so I'm going to kind of go through and talk about some of the pros and accomplishments, I think, that are in there, and then talk about some of the weaknesses based on the program we put together and the recommendations we had. In terms of the policy, I mean, I think it's clear there was a lot of very early leadership on it, a quick order from the president, second day in office, to say, I want a major policy shift. It was coupled with another memo on FOIA. It made it very clear that the goal of this administration, a very high-profile goal, was going to be changing things. The eventual Open Government Directive also puts a lot of emphasis on changes to policy, new plans that have to come out from the agency-specific plans. It also has a role for OIRA to go through and review other policies that exist right now, regulatory or statutory, over the next 120 days, and figure out if there are any impediments to these agencies being more open. And I have to say, I think there are. It's just from having worked with a lot of these agencies, it's not just a matter of having a new policy that says be open. It's a matter of getting some of the other policies, the older policies, such as the cookie policy and others out there. The Paperwork Reduction Act itself probably needs both an overhaul in terms of how it's implemented, but maybe a larger statutory review and reauthorization. But and I think it's good that the Open Government Directive policy recognizes that, that it says there's probably other things going on here that we have to identify and figure out how to fix. And even though we spent quite a bit of time coming up with the directive itself, this is an ongoing process, and one of the next steps is to figure out those other policies that are in the way. On the technology, there's a whole section that puts emphasis on both online technology as well as, or online data, I should say, as well as an emphasis on trying new technologies, more interactive technologies. There's the Open Government Directive web pages that all the agencies have to launch now. There'll be an online web page at the White House as well. And so there's good emphasis there. I think that's where, I'll be a little more specific, I think there's a weakness there. It may be a result of not wanting to get too specific in the directive and overly prescriptive to the agencies, but I think I would have liked to have seen a little bit more on what the agency should try and address, or maybe it's the interagency working group. And then on the cultural, again, there's a There's a review that will happen over 120 days to investigate how the government might actually make incentives to be more open. The government is, during our deliberations for the 21st Century Right to Know Project, we heard a lot of people explaining that there were people inside government who would love to be more open. But the phrase we heard from someone was, no one ever gets promoted for releasing information, but you can get fired if you release the wrong document. And so the idea of changing that, of actually trying to figure out a way to make it where you can get credit for being more open, where an agency or an office can somehow get an incentive or give incentives out to its employees to say, this is a positive. We want you to be trying new things. We want you to be innovative and take some risks. And there are rewards out there to be gotten. And I think that's going to be another important process that's going to happen later. It didn't happen now, but it's on the board. I think also in terms of culture, just the way the Open Government Directive was built or discussed, the online deliberation that occurred. And I know a lot of people in this room who participated in the process can probably list off a lot of the pitfalls that the online discussion kind of fell into, the lack of moderation from the administration, a certain lack of clarity for each of the – there were three stages, a brainstorming stage, a debating stage where it was a discussion stage about the top ideas, and then a drafting stage. And it didn't work perfectly, but it was the first time they really tried this. But I think it was important that, again, they sent a message to everyone that we are doing things differently. We expect you to do things differently. And finally, this dashboard that's going to get put up, I think, is also very important in terms of changing culture. You're going to have incentives, but you also have to have a certain level of accountability to say, this is important, and we're going to be very open and upfront with the public as to how we're all doing about this. It creates a lot of incentive, a lot of pressure to do well. It creates a certain level of competition within agencies. If another agency is doing great and your agency is floundering, you're going to want to move forward and make up some of that ground. Hopefully it also creates some collaboration between the agencies to say, exactly how did you do that? If you see another agency and it's on the dashboard, very public, the agencies can go to each other and figure out exactly how they solve certain problems, whether it's privacy or certain technology problems. I want to talk a little bit about the weaknesses. And the good news is, I think, while there are several weaknesses, I think there are weaknesses that can be addressed in the process that have been outlined for going forward with the Open Government Directive. One of the probably most prominent ones when looked at from the perspective of the recommendations we gave the Obama administration would be the management structure. Felt it was very important to have a very clear management structure in terms of who's responsible in an agency. At the White House, there were recommendations for new offices or new officers in terms of transparency, not just about a CIO. It's broader than that. It's about disclosure. It's about open meetings. It's about technology. It's about culture. And so the idea was to create a sort of new leadership. And while we're getting a lot of leadership on this issue, and that is terrific, the directive itself doesn't, I think, spell out clearly enough who's responsible for what. Certain pieces are assigned, but other pieces are left a little up in the air. I think another big missing component would be resources. Agencies are stretched thin right now. The technology and the extra effort that personnel are going to have to put forward to be more open, to overcome concerns and resistance, it's going to take more resources. And as of right now, those resources aren't clearly delineated in this process, and I think it's something that needs to be addressed. And as I said, I think it still can be. two other pieces. One would be enforcement. I spoke highly a moment ago about the incentives, and I certainly meant that. I'd like to see it be more of a process that is focused on the positive, to make openness a good thing. But for every carrot, there should also be a stick. And there's not a clear enforcement mechanism here to operate also as a stick. About the best we have is the embarrassment factor. If agencies aren't getting their plans up online on time, then they're not going to appear well in the dashboard. But there's no real penalties. There's no real with no one in charge to go knock heads together, as sometimes is necessary. I do worry that some agencies are going to comply with the letter and not the spirit, and really lag behind. And if there was more enforcement, a little bit more in terms of teeth, they might be more motivated. And the last piece would be a disclosure floor. This idea that while I do like the fact that each agency is different, each agency has its own constituencies that they want to be open to, who need different things. And so the flexibility designed in the Open Government Directive is wise for that in that sense. But I think there's still, even though there's a wide range of issues that the agencies cover, I think there are some consistent items that the agencies all should be disclosing. I mean, they all have budgets. They all do federal contracts and grants. They all have employees that work for them in different offices, and they should have directories on how to contact those employees. And so I think there could have been here, and there still could be, this prescription to agencies that these are some of the planks to a floor that you should all have, and then on that floor you should be building whatever it is your users, your audience really needs you to build. Now I think, as I said, I think the process moving forward, we have a lot of options here. We have the ongoing reviews, and then I think the piece that's really hopeful for me is the interagency working group. And I think this agency could really wrestle with some of these things. I mean, the disclosure floor, the management structure, enforcement, even resources. If those are problems that they are told to wrestle with, I think we can get something very good out of those, and we could be taking second, third, fourth steps down the road in what should be an iterative process. But I'll stop there.
Great. Well, why don't we hear from a journalist perspective now. Clint, do you want to pick up?
Sure. Well, thanks very much to Dan for the invitation today, and Gary, thank you very much for the introduction. Hopefully it's been long enough that you guys will have forgotten it, because I can't possibly live up to it. But I'd like to start by remembering back to 1 year ago, when many of us were in this room before, and the Obama administration had just made a big splash, and on their first full day in office, as Sean mentioned, issued the memorandum on FOIA and the Open Government Directive. It was certainly a way to say that they meant business. But when you sat down and looked at the Open Government Directive, you know, it had these three really big words: collaboration, participation, and transparency. And not a lot, or sorry, not the Open Government Directive, let me correct myself, memo starting the process for the Open Government Directive. And so what was going to be behind those words, we didn't know yet. And we had to wait some time for the directive. There was a deadline in it that there's a date in it that at first read looked like a deadline and then turned out not to quite be a deadline in the end. And when it came down to it, this directive mostly focuses, although not exclusively, on the dissemination of government data online, which is an incredibly important and worthy process. Unfortunately, whenever a journalist hears the word transparency, for better or worse, they pretty much think of FOIA. And the reason for that is the journalists are intimately familiar with using FOIA in the course of their reporting. And then also, if you want to get historical about it, back in 1966, journalists were really very, very involved in behind-the-scenes movement in order to get that law passed. And it's a great story. But the Open Government Directive, while not focusing on FOIA, there are some hints in it, the Open Government Directive, about improving the FOIA process. And while it's definitely not the bulk of the document, I'm going to spend a decent amount of time talking about that. Most significantly is the stipulation that agencies with significant backlogs, and the directive does not quite define significant, must set in motion plans to reduce that backlog by 10% per year. And it requires that milestones be, that's the word they use, be set up for this evaluation. It doesn't really set out what those milestones are, and it doesn't set out when they'll be. But there are enough hints and enough in the spirit of the language around it that I think it's safe to say that we, if the Open Government Directive doesn't get us all the way there and doesn't explicitly say it, I think it certainly gets us on the threshold of some sort of regular release of government data that can be used to easily compare various agencies' responsiveness rates to the Freedom of Information Act and their effectiveness in fulfilling requests under the law. On the day the Open Government Directive was finally rolled out in the webcast, the administration also put forward a list of 20 commitments, agency-specific commitments, that were sort of the first round of projects that each agency had agreed to undertake as part of their fulfillment of the initiative. And the very first one on the list was from the Justice Department, and the Justice Department from going forward would be releasing their FOIA compliance stats in an online machine-readable format. And it also said that it was likely that it says that as more and more agencies do this, it will provide an opportunity for the media, for advocacy organizations, for the non-governmental organization community to monitor for compliance. It's not hard to see that if you have every agency reporting in a relatively standard format on a relatively standard set of data, that we would no longer have to just rely on the Rosemary Award, which is a great thing, but it's sort of a one agency spotlighted each year. We would no longer have to rely on the work that Rick Bloom was talking about earlier today of going through and really painstakingly collating these various sets of data. Now, will the Open Government Dashboard at the White House be the place where this sort of comparison case by case thing can be compiled and made? I'm not sure. Will it be something that the Office of Information and Privacy, which is the department in the Justice Department that's most likely to do it, or would it be, as Patrice was beseeching Miriam earlier today, would it be OGIS? Who knows? And it might not be any of those three. It might just be that the data will be harnessed by somebody outside of government, maybe somebody like the Columbia Journalism Review or the Collaboration or the Sunlight Foundation or OMB Watch, who can set up this sort of tracker. But that is, I think, very much the intent of the way that this data that's going to come out from the Open Government Directive, not just the FOIA data, but all the other data, too, is that it's out there to be reused and repurposed by anyone who has an idea of what it can be used for. So putting that aside, I'd like to move on to the other part of, which, of course, is the bulk of the Open Government Directive, which is just this push for more data out there. Journalists are already making use of publicly available databases from governments at all levels as much as they can in traditional outlets. I'm thinking my hometown paper, I know the Louisville Courier Journal posts municipal salaries on the website. You can type in an employer, you can type in an apartment, you can type in a salary range, find out who's getting paid what. I know there are papers in Tennessee that put the gun license database online. So if you have a gun license in Tennessee, you can find out if your neighbor does. You can find out if that person who's been sending threatening letters does. In the wake of the Interstate 35 bridge collapse, the Minneapolis bridge collapse a couple summers ago, MSNBC.com went and got all the federal data, which was ranking, it was bridge inspection data. And they said, type in your work and type in your home, and we'll tell you what bridges you drive over and how well inspected they are. And it was quite surprising. Now, that last example is the only one I said that was federal. And I think to some extent that shows that, there's been a lot going on the local level with this and that that the federal government has some catch-up to do. But at the same time, this directive, if it really if the enforcement concerns that Sean was talking about work through and we really do see this kind of data coming out, we could also see blowback to federal and state levels where this information, where much you know, important public information is kept in ways that it's difficult for journalists and the public to get access to. I think at this point it's hard not to mention the dramatic changes that are going on in the journalism world. And there have been entire conferences on that. There are probably a couple this week. And I won't get into it. But at the same time that the internet is undermining, changing, challenging the economic model that has supported journalism for so much of the last 100 years, it is also opening up opportunities for regular citizens to apply their eyes to these types of data sets. And I think that there are all sorts of new collaborative forms of journalism that are emerging that can really, with expert work from sort of this new generation of journalists slash programmers and also contributions from the public, could really harness this new data that we're getting out and provide a lot of new information and analysis on important matters of public interest. The institutional home of the Columbia Journalism Review, which is the Columbia School of Journalism, in the fall published a study by Leonard Downey, the former editor of the Washington Post, and Michael Schutzen, who's a communications professor at the Journalism School. And of their six major recommendations for what could be done to help journalism through this crisis, dark valley, whatever you want to call it, one of them was to encourage and work with government to release more and more data in more ways online and in accessible ways. So I think that you can definitely see the way that these two problems are related and that this represents a real opportunity at a time when the method, the journalistic method of dissemination of information to the public is being challenged. So with that, I'd be happy to take your questions.
Well, we're going to hold on the questions until we get through Bert to wrap us up and give us kind of an overview of how this all fits together. You're going to wave a wand?
Fit my notes again. Let me start with a brief personal observation. This conference has been a really good tonic for me because for the past week, watching TV has been deeply depressing. I represented the constitutional government of Haiti for the decade of the 90s, spent a lot of time there, and made a number of good friends in the government and elsewhere whose whereabouts are uncertain. So it does my heart good to be reminded of what an ever-growing panoply of NGOs, academics, and congressional offices are now committed, so committed to transparent government. My wife is the cup is half full person in our house. I'm the cup is half empty person, so she tends to be happier. Before I lapse into dismay again about today's consensus of concerns about how real the administration's open government is and its record in many disappointing areas so far, let me say that when it comes to transparency, we have come a long way since I started working in the Senate 40 years ago. Back then, congressional committee markups, where they vote on the bills, were all done behind closed doors, unlike hearings. There were no lobbying, foreign agent, or campaign finance filings required. And the FOIA was then in its infancy before the Sunshine Act. In the Congress, only a handful of senators and congressmen were really committed to opening the government to make it more accountable. So we've really come a long way. But having tasted the heady brew of access to government files, citizens want more, and that's why we're here today. Obama repeatedly says he agrees with our basic premise. Openness promotes accountability, strengthens democracy, promotes effectiveness, and permits public participation. Citizens need to know what's going on. His administration has been a cornucopia of pronouncements, guidelines, executive orders, speeches, And as others today have said, the rhetoric has been very good. In addition, there have been some significant departures from the last 8 years' wasteland, and a return to what we older Lone Ranger fans knew as the golden days of yesteryear. But there have been some glaring failures of reform, as you've also heard. As the New York Times editorial said, quote, "The Obama administration has clung for so long to the Bush administration's expansive claims of national security and executive power that it is in danger of turning President George Bush's cover-up of abuses committed in the name of fighting terrorism into President Barack Obama's cover-up." These issues we've talked about today fall into two basic categories. First, there's the goal of making improvements in getting information out to the public that the government wants to disseminate. The second goal is requiring disclosure of information when many in the government may not want to do so. That's my focus. How can we enforce the latter? First, let me make a few specific comments on topics in the previous panels. In 1973, as I mentioned, I wrote an amendment that would have required the judge in FOIA challenges that go to court in the national security area to review de novo, that means from scratch, how the purpose of FOIA would be balanced or should be balanced against the alleged national security concerns. And unfortunately, as a number of you know, that was essentially neutered by conference language about giving excessive deference to the executive branch, which I raised in the questions. I think that many of the reforms in the FOIA guidelines and even in some of the legislation of the last few years have been in the areas of deadlines and fees and other bureaucratic paperwork, but not necessarily in the core standards. The four main improvements, at least from the last 8 years, are what I call the three D's: when justice will defend, what people should do when in doubt, and how they should exercise their discretion. But we're still waiting to see, and so far, as you've heard, there have been some discouraging indications. An editorial by the Daily News hit the nail on the head, as others have said here. Quote, "Absent strict oversight of agency handling of requests, the new instructions are just words." In the area of secrecy, which is something I've been interested in since 1962, again, I think that the executive order makes a number of important additions, heavily on the declassification side, which is very important, but I'm more interested in whether something should be classified in the first place than whether it's declassified in 3 years or 10 years or 15 years, even though that is important. With regard to the core issue of how can you cut down on classification, there are really two levels of excessive classification that are quite distinct. One are items that shouldn't be classified at all. And obviously, attacking that has a direct benefit for the public's knowledge. The indirect level that I've also worked on a lot is reducing classification. The main benefit of that, although there is a benefit in terms of more people in the government having access in the executive branch, as a creature of Congress, I think the main benefit is that as a practical matter, in real terms, something reduced from compartmented or special access to top secret or even secret, if that's appropriate, dramatically will increase the number of members of Congress who will see it. Even though as a constitutional matter, members of Congress do not need clearance and they have a constitutional right to see everything. But in the real world, not only will the whole Intelligence Committee not necessarily see it, or Armed Services, not only will members outside the committees not see it, but members of those committees will not necessarily see it if it's overclassified to too high a level. And I've tried to grapple with this. I mentioned two things in the questions. I won't repeat. But there are two other things that I've looked at. One is the idea of codifying the important parts of the executive order. It's been a roller coaster. Carter improves it. Reagan cuts it back. Clinton improves it. Bush cuts it back. And not only that, but if you stop and think about it, since an executive order is not a statute, the president can change it at a moment's notice. He can decide tomorrow that he doesn't like a particular part that the previous panel worked so hard on, and he could change it in a flash, especially if it deals with something he wants to classify or have a higher classification than it otherwise might have. So I think that that's one point. The second point, which is really radical, but I would propose that in Congress there be an Office of Security Classification functioning like the independent experts on the Congressional Budget Office or the old Office of Technology Assessment. They would be like people like Bill Leonard, perhaps someday Mr. Leahy, and if Congress gets a document from the executive that's highly classified about which a recipient committee has questions, they would refer to this office, which would have no power to change its classification, certainly not in the executive branch. But it could make recommendations to the committee and the speaker, which might then lead the Congress to treat the document at the appropriate level of classification. You might get into a fight and the executive says, we're not going to give you any more. Congress says, we have the power of the purse over your operations. The executive says, we dare you, and then Congress probably would fold, but at least as a concept. The overall theme, I think, emerging today for the open government directive, like the other promises, will depend on how it works in practice. As this panel's moderator said, quote, it will depend on how the public, the White House, and federal agencies work together to implement the directive. So my focus will be on how to test the directive, take its temperature. Patrice McDermott asked a question today she had noted earlier when she said that under the directive, quote, agencies are required to put up their own government plans, but there's no indication of who's going to oversee them and oversee their implementation. It is if OMB expects the public to do this. I don't know if that's quite fair, because I think the Office of Government Information Services clearly sees itself and clearly was intended by Congress to a substantial extent to have that role. But I'll get back to oversight in a minute. Nonetheless, when I finished reading the entire directive, I was still hungry, wondering how it would be enforced. I was reminded of the closing line in Philip Roth's famous novel, Portnoy's Complaint. After hundreds of pages of Portnoy telling his psychiatrist his psychosexual history, his analyst's reaction ends the book when he says in his Viennese accent, good, now we begin. Oversight and enforcement of the governments of open government will be on three levels: internally within the executive, congressional oversight, and oversight by the public, especially NGOs. Obama's fine memos and statements call to mind Richard Neustadt's seminal book, Presidential Power, in which he quotes Harry Truman on the surprise in store for Eisenhower upon his election. Quote, poor Ike, it won't be like the Army. He'll find it very frustrating. He'll sit here day after day saying, do this, do that, and nothing will happen. Neustadt's point is that, notwithstanding all the president's constitutional powers as the, if I can use the word, unitary head of the executive branch, his real job is to persuade others in Washington, including those in his own administration, to do what they should do, sometimes with his prestige and advocacy, sometimes with sticks and carrots. but he cannot say what he wants done or even issue proclamations and executive orders and expect that it will just happen. In the case of transparency, why might his policies not necessarily be implemented? Let me count the ways. For several reasons. One, people in the trenches who decide what to disclose or their superiors would be personally or politically embarrassed. Two, it would reveal inefficiencies or incompetent or wasteful action and lead to more of the growing trend towards privatization of government functions. Three, it's inevitable, I think, human nature, that even the best public servants at Justice and the White House wear two hats. They're the lawyers, or at least the White House counsel's office. They're the lawyers for the president, and in a real sense, they're the lawyers for the country and the Constitution. But I think when you're politically appointed, you're in there, there's a crisis, there's headlines, the pundits are screaming at television, it's a very human tendency to focus on that first hat. And in the case of previous administrations, the harm, the political harm, to an incumbent White House is that it might be seen as attacking too much its political successors. This might be even particularly relevant if you've campaigned as ending the era of partisanship. It also could create problems between management and government unions. I've been told of several agencies where this impacts FOIA practice in the real world. With regard to the Office of Government Information Services, I look forward to its ambitious agenda and its great responsibilities. I'd have two suggestions. One, I would put less emphasis on whether someone in the mediation side has experience in FOIA generally or in mediation. And I would make sure that they have experience in national security information disclosure, either in the FOIA area or in other spheres, at least for a cadre to work on those kinds of cases. My experience, and I've had access both in the nuclear weapons area and in the intelligence area to the most sensitive paper in the government, is that most of the time, this is going to be provocative, but that most of the time, with good intention and sufficient effort, you can work out a way not only to lower the classification, but to declassify the information with some substitution, some redaction, but still get the gist of it out. And mediators are not arbitrators, but they can be more or less proactive. And the more sense they have of that, I think the more they can help bring the parties together. Pat Wald, when she was a judge once on an appeal from a FOIA case, appointed a very experienced former CIA person, White House Justice Department intelligence official, to be a special master. And I think she said they reduced something like 800 differences down to about 4, and the rest were worked out. With regard to the, again, internal mechanisms, there hasn't been much discussion of the inspector generals, and I don't know how much these new programs are designed to replace them. They vary in quality. Some are outstanding, particularly Inspector General Fine at the Justice Department has done some incredibly thorough and hard-hitting work, and I would try to find a way to bring them into it. The one Inspector General, in fact, at OMB has complained to Congress that one of his people was threatened by the White House that if they complained they didn't have enough resources, he would rue the day. And I would hope that if the Inspector General gets into the question of transparency from any angle, and they've gotten into some with regard to the Bureau, that the Office of Government Information Services looks at that as well. I would be careful of modifying phrases in the executive order and elsewhere, like for the purpose of or to the minimal extent necessary or except where agency concerns, because those are the loopholes that will be the administration will be driving through. I don't want to be a dog in the manger after all today's optimism, but I was struck by President Obama's statement in China, freedom of access to information and participation, we believe, are universal rights. Then I thought of his administration's practices thus far, especially in state secrets, but also other areas. And then I thought of the popular movie Working Girl. Melanie Griffith plays a Wall Street secretary with dreams of becoming a Wall Street merger specialist. Her girlfriend, played by Joan Cusack, is skeptical about her aspirations. And at some point, exasperated, she tells Griffith, listen, you know, you can dance in front of a mirror and you're slip with a guitar, but that doesn't make you Madonna. Based on what we've seen so far, maybe someone will have to tell President Obama, you know, you can make a lot of lofty pronouncements, issue a lot of guidelines about transparency. That doesn't mean you've opened the government where it really counts. And for closing, on a more serious note, we just celebrated Martin Luther King's birthday. In 1968, in his famous speech at the Riverside Church in New York, he became the first national leader to unequivocally oppose the war in Vietnam. He was warned by civil rights allies in Johnson's White House this would hurt his ability to advance civil rights. And King responded in his speech that there comes a time when silence is betrayal. I think what today's conference has shown me is that we will be betraying the cause of transparent government if we remain silent when the administration doesn't do whatever is necessary down in the operating trenches and also in the White House strategy sessions to make good on its proud promises of open government.
Thanks for taking us beyond the OGD. Before I ask you all a question, because I know you're getting ready to ask your questions of us, I actually want to comment about a day I missed since I wasn't here. There is a tendency when those of us who are knowledgeable about transparency issues, we get together and we dissect things, we tend to really do a great job of dissecting. I just want to remind us that not more than a year and a half ago, we were bemoaning the major secrecy in government. And I think sometimes, I know I've been asked a lot, to grade this administration, which my immediate reaction is that's pretty hard to do. It's hard to reduce to a grade something that's an evolving process. But having said that, there's a tendency to grade on what basis when you have to do it. A question that I often have is, what's the benchmark you want to compare against? You know, we took a few items today and talked about them, but there are a whole heck of a lot of things that we may not have talked about. We have a president, as Bert just described, who has talked about transparency. We have a White House staff in place that is focused on transparency, something that has never really occurred. We had the experience with the Recovery Act in the immediacy of putting out data on recovery. We have the White House logs that were now disclosed. We have, if you go down to the agency level, remarkable activities in some agencies. I happen to track a lot of work at EPA. It is, they have undone damage that was done, at least for the toxics release inventory, and they have put out memos talking about operating in a fishbowl. It is a very different environment than what it was a year and a half ago. Having said that, I'm an advocate. And as an advocate, I can never be pleased. I always, whenever get something, have one more item beyond that. And all of us should have that. I think that's good. But I also think there's a time and a place to reflect on where we've just come from and where we are. And it is remarkable, from my perspective as an advocate, how much change has occurred in such a short period of time. So I wanted to throw that out, knowing that it was a day of tough discussion about very detailed elements. I just hope all of us, when we walk out of here later today, sort of step back and think about the bigger picture instead of every single item. Then go to every single item and beat the heck out of them. Now, having said that, by show of hands, how many of you do believe, I'll give you the choice of things have gotten better since the Bush era of secrecy, or they have not gotten better?
That's a low bar.
That's a pretty low
bar. Fair enough, a low bar. I just want to see, how many think things have gotten better?
Raise both hands.
There you go. I think it's important for us to reflect on that as we discuss these issues. We tend to get mired in all the detail and forget about where we've been. Let me ask a second question. How many of you were involved in the process that Alex described with the OGD, one of those three phases in some way? How many? Look how few. Isn't that intriguing? Was it four? Five? Not even. Yeah. That's amazing. The last question that I want to ask is, Clint put before us a proposal for the OGD that said there should be a FOIA dashboard, as they're talking about open government dashboards. How many people think that's a priority for this White House to do, to have a FOIA dashboard in the way he was describing? So about half the room. How many don't know? Don't have a feeling, yeah. Okay, I just wanted to get, you know, you involved a little bit for a second. Now let me ask you, come forward and ask questions of the panel, and then I will allow for some interaction also among the panel. Those of you who have questions, come on, step forward. The cookie's waiting.
Is that a real cookie, Gary?
I promise to deliver a cookie at a later time. And say who you are.
Michael Binder, Air Force Declassification Office. I think this question is for Alexander Hunt. Now, maybe I'm mistaken. There seems to be an implication that the Obama administration is limited to departments and agencies. But there's a West Wing and an old executive office building and a new executive office building. And, well, if he serves two terms, we have to wait 12 years before his records will start to be available, 12 years from this date. So if he's really true to the notion of transparency, I would expect to see presidential records being released on a fairly regular basis, well, starting a year ago, I guess. So when might that happen? Otherwise, it's a lot of do as I say and not as I do.
I'm afraid I can't speak on behalf of the administration with respect to that question, but there is the Presidential Records Act that applies to presidential records. Nothing we're doing in any way changes legal obligations that exist. What I would say and can report on is that the Open Government Initiative was hosted on whitehouse.gov, and it was a component of the Executive Office of the President, the Office of Science and Technology Policy, that led that public engagement. And OSTP, along with OMB, Council of Environmental Quality, the U.S. Trade Representative's Office, and Office of National Drug Control Policy are all agencies subject to the directive, and all of us are following up and doing our best to meet the requirements of the directive. So you do have components of the Executive Office of the President fully engaged, and five of which who are responding just like the other agencies and departments of the executive branch.
I'm thinking about chief of staff, for example. Redact out the swear words, but seeing memos there for things that have been completed. legislation that has passed. We can start to see memos between the president and his advisors in that regard. I'm just saying transparency and transparency, and it would be nice to see it extended that far.
Do you think the paperwork, the Presidential Records Act and the other PRA needs to be amended?
Well, I don't know that the Presidential Records Act prohibits the president from releasing anything now.
Right.
It just says that 5 years after the last day. So there's nothing that stops him from releasing his own stuff now.
Good evening. Jason Allen with the Collaboration on Government Secrecy. Mr. Hunt, my question is also to you. Regarding the Open Government Directive, there is a segment in there that mandates that agencies with a significant backlog would have to reduce that backlog by 10% each year. I was just wondering what sort of procedures your office plans on implementing or would like to see those other agencies implement in order to actually do this.
My recollection is that's part of the web pages that agencies create for open government, and additional guidance may be necessary, but we leave it up to agencies to respond to that directive given their particular circumstances. And the Department of Justice also has a role in reviewing its guidance to agencies following up the Attorney General's memo to agencies last year. That's what I know at the moment.
I would actually ask a follow-up question, or maybe even a sub-question to that, which is a question I had when I saw that provision was, what constitutes a significant backlog, and who's gonna define that? Who's gonna sit in judgment of you have a significant backlog, and another agency, while large, is not significant, they don't have to meet these deadlines?
Well, it's been noted with respect to other provisions in the directive that it's not overly prescriptive, and it is a framework, mm-hmm. which allows for, we think, agency-specific solutions and responses to the various instructions. So I would put that in that category, but that's an obvious question. It's one we haven't dealt with respect to following up the agencies on that particular deliverable, but it's certainly a question that is likely to come up in that context, and if we see a need for clarifying guidance, we would be certain to provide it.
Just one second. If I could jump in and make a suggestion, there's a number that readily comes to mind, which is 20 days, which would be the statutory requirement for response. So that would probably be everybody would have a significant backlog. But
Meredith Fuchs, National Security Archive. I find myself in the awkward position of yet again trying to defend the administration on something when my job is generally to be challenging them. But for the benefit of Mr. Hunt, I'm going to just make a comment about presidential records. This administration has done something which, for the last several administrations, we've not managed to get them to do on their own. Well, I shouldn't say on their own, because, of course, we had to sue in the Bush administration to get it here. But they're actually preserving their records, which, is the first step to actually releasing them. And, the Bush administration, frankly, had lost over 20 million emails, and only litigation caused that to be found, those to be found, and more to be restored. And the Obama administration has put in a system which, assuming it works, will prevent that from happening and will make sure that the materials are preserved. So that is a tremendous first step and an important first step. So in the spirit of Gary, I want to give them credit for that, because it's something that we worked really hard to accomplish. I would also throw out the release of visitor records by the White House. Is, I think, also an important demonstration of a commitment to transparency, although there are problems with that, and we might want to see it be quicker and be more complete. I mean, frankly, they are opening themselves up to a fair bit of criticism, because people are tearing those visitor records apart and pointing out the lobbyists and the this and the that who are going. And so they're kind of taking the heat a little bit, but hopefully changing the culture so whoever the next president is will have to continue that
process. Meredith, didn't they resist that fiercely until there was an imminent likelihood of a judicial requirement?
They did resist it, and they haven't conceded anything on the actual legal situation. It's a discretionary release of records.
I have a – you have a question? Go ahead.
My name is Katie Hinkle. I'm a student here at the law school, and Mr. Hendler, I received a tip that you have a report card for the administration. I was wondering if you'd be willing to say the grades thus far.
Sure. I think you stole Gary's question. So, before I lay them out, I would like to sort of latch myself onto Gary's caveats that, you know, this is, of course, when I was a student, the professor would generally set out, you know, what the grades would be on the beginning of the term. And I had to, you know, I knew the final was 30% and the paper was 25% and class participation. And unfortunately, Obama didn't get that benefit from me or from Dan or from any of the panelists who came up here today and gave their grades on FOIA. Not that the administration would have concerned themselves with meeting those marks, but that being said. So basically, I just looked down the list of a few key things. There's a lot of stuff I left off that I could have included, and said, you know, measure it up against what I would like to see, and, you know, with the understanding that I'm one person and that I may be asking more than any administration would be able to give, I just put letter grades on it and said, this is how far you come in my mind. And I'm happy to give detail on any particular thing, if you know, great, if somebody has a specific question. But on state secrets, I gave the administration a D. On FOIA, a B. On the open government directive, an incomplete. At the time of the report card, it actually was incomplete. So on online data, I gave a D plus. On visitor records, an A minus. On their work for the SHIELD law, which is we haven't really talked about today at all, a B, and on background briefings, which is a particular sort of ground rule governed conference call with reporters, or sometimes in a room where you're not allowed to identify who's giving you the administration position, I gave an F.
Can I ask why you gave him a D on state secrets instead of an E or an F? No, seriously.
That's a good question. Because I guess some points were rhetoric, and some points were laying out a set of standards that I feel that if they actually sincerely applied, might make a difference.
But well, let me point out that the administration has said they would not oppose, but they would not support the legislation on state secrets, which they know in this town is a death knell. But with regard to the AG's new tough standards, when I asked senior officials at Justice why they would only be effective October 1 and not to previous pending cases where they're pursuing the Bushes almost word for word, as you heard, I was told that they had run those cases under the new standards and they all passed. And when we had a conference here on state secrets at the end of last year, it was pointed out that in the Jepson case about rendition, you know, maybe three people in Fiji who don't know about that. So why would just having litigation per se be so harmful? And the Justice Department person said, it was in regard to AT&T and the fact that they don't want to identify who was involved, that in the future, if they were asked to help, they might not help in the future. And it seems to me that that logic means that if the government had, the CIA had asked the mafia to kill a foreign, they did do that, and the names of those people came out, that could chill the willingness of mafia in the future to kill foreign leaders. I mean, I would give them an E or an F.
Maybe I was too generous.
Let me ask the panel a question about OGD. Alex, you described one of the elements is this Friday the agencies are going to be releasing three high-value data sets. Clint, you mentioned that, and so did Alex, mentioned that the directive describes a little bit of what high-value means, or actually Sean did, I'm sorry. What do the panelists actually think about what high value should really, how should agencies begin to implement that even after Friday's release, since that's just the beginning?
Well, I mentioned that by high value, we have in mind information when disseminated, helping the agency achieve policy and programmatic objectives. I gave the example of the USDA data on commonly consumed foods. And the other piece was usefulness to the public of having access to that information. And we see the initial three data sets from each agency on Friday being a first step. And with respect to whether we're setting a floor or ceiling, it's a floor or a down payment, if you will. We fully expect agencies after Friday to continue to upload high-value data sets on data.gov and achieve the broader culture change that's been discussed. The directive itself is again, not prescriptive, doesn't have penalties for noncompliance. That's not the thrust or strategy here. It's rather getting senior officials together, collaborating, and figuring out ways to make government more open, transparent, collaborative, participatory, and frankly using the public and public interest groups as a way to keep agencies accountable. And and I'll end with this, just as an example of how that can work on the IT dashboard, where the administration is disclosing detailed information about the progress and performance of IT investments. The VA, based on information on the IT dashboard made public, decided to discontinue, I believe, 13 projects. So there are ways that this approach can make government more accountable and affect agency decisions in a positive way.
Any of the other panelists want to say what they would like to see the administration do in terms of high-value data sets and what that actually means?
I'll jump in and say that I think Alex is saying a lot that I agree with in terms of I might switch it, make the usefulness to the public a little bit higher of importance than necessarily the agencies kind of putting their mission first. I think the idea of disclosing it means you expect either the public or some intermediary between the public, whether it's journalists or other groups out there, to take it and use it for this accountability function, which I think is really the key here in terms of value. I think one of the other things I would say is it should be something that is either traditionally difficult or if not released in the past. I mean, there's been some debate over that as to whether or not the directive said that it wasn't available or it wasn't available online easily. But if you're really talking about something that's going to be of high value, it's going to be something that people want to use to hold the government or the regulated community or somebody accountable, and it's going to be something that we weren't getting before. I mean, that's what's going to make it high value. I mean, top of my list would be things like contracts or contractor performance. I mean, we have a lot more information, especially coming out of recovery, about who's getting money and for what, but we don't actually know whether or not the public got what it paid for.
I would add two things. One is that it seems to me like looking at FOIA requests for data sets would be a great place to start. That's a way of gauging what people are interested in. And then maybe also less formal methods of people calling and asking about liaison officers. But I think in addition to high value, we have to look at quality and timeliness. Are these data sets that, as interesting as it would be to see agricultural growing data from 1850s to 1950s, and there would be somebody who really likes that, I'm sure. I think things that are measuring the contemporary world would really be a priority in my mind.
Gary, can I make a comment on your comment?
Oh, okay.
first, I want to, pardon me, my voice is going, make it clear, I worked very hard for President Obama's election, and I have high hopes for his presidency. All appearances to the contrary, notwithstanding. Secondly, I'm sure they don't want as their transparency epitaph to be, we are better off than we were under Vice President Cheney. But third and most important, what I'm concerned about, with all respect to all the good work that's gone on and will go on, is that we don't take the staffing up of a lot of offices, the issue of a lot of sub-directives, the creation of value sets, and so forth, juxtaposed to a continuation of very bad decisions that you've heard about today, and I could go on at great length, in the concrete decision-making in freedom of action, freedom of information, state secrets, classification, and so forth, or refusal to make things public that are asked for, and put that aside and say, well, now we have transparency in government in terms of all the superstructure that's created. And I just think it's important to keep our eye on the ball.
Let's see who you are, Mary.
Thank you. Thank you, Gary. First of all, I want to thank the panel. All of you have raised different points that have been very helpful, I think, to all of us in thinking about the directive, what it can do, how it can be implemented. You've raised some interesting questions about enforcement and also incentives. Here's something I would like to, I guess I would direct this to Clint, but also to Alex, to Sean, and Bert, to you also in spreading the word. And Gary, you've been doing this for a long time. And that is, one incentive, a big incentive, I think, for officials in affirmative disclosure as well as disclosure on demand is hearing back what has been done with the information, what has been done with the records, how has it been transformed if their data, or what kind of stories have come out of the information. Now, sometimes we know that the result is the agency is going to be criticized. It's going to be using that information to criticize something, a particular program, or the way the agency is doing its work. But that's the accountability piece. That's what we all are looking for, as the good as well as the bad. But it would really be great to know what happens to the information. And if there's some way to encourage that and feed it back to the agencies and have that also be disclosed so that others can see what came of it. It also, besides informing the public, is perhaps a way that the officials who have made disclosures can get support from their leadership, because you're seeing real results.
Before the panelists respond, let me ask you to respond to your own question. Do you think the OGD can get you closer to that storytelling, maybe through the dashboard, maybe through open government plans? Are there any vehicles that you could envision within the directive that could get you closer to that?
Well, yeah, I think there are several places. I mean, we can start with the data sets, and I think everybody, or most of you, have addressed that in terms of those being available in terms of FOIA, in terms of performance there. But if we're looking at plans by agencies for how they're going to improve things, if we're going to see ways that if there's going to be some information sharing about the good practices and the plans, the way of reducing backlogs, the way of using technology, for example, to make the processes work better, those are all things. The collaboration with the public, the ways of collaborating better. I forget the term that I think Alex used for, or maybe someone else earlier talked about, the public engagement plans, and that's also a bit of feedback and on how requests are being responded to, how the collaboration is going, the affirmative disclosures, all of it.
Yeah, the open government web pages that agencies are to create must have a public engagement capability so that agencies could ask the public how they've used data sets published on data.gov. And I should mention, just because I don't think we've touched on it, is that the data sets can be used in combination. The kids call it mashing data. And that can lead to all sorts of new innovative uses of government information that's disseminated.
And Alex, correct me if I'm wrong, but doesn't the it's hard to keep straight every web page around the initiative, but there's been some that have actually spotlighted, thank you, that have spotlighted mashups and other projects that have harnessed this data already, right?
Are you talking about government websites?
No, outside websites using the government data, sort of saying, like, here's a neat project that somebody did with X.
Well, yes.
Yeah.
Someone, I forget the URL, but has taken Federal Register information and created a Federal Register that's more searchable, that's tagged for key terms, so that, and not making any value judgments about whether GPO access is more or less useful than this other website, but it is it seeks to make it easier for the public to find regulations of interest if they want to comment on a proposed rule. So yes, that is happening.
Right, and my point being is that there's an example of government being willing to show the results of this data coming out. In terms of more regularly the agencies hearing back, I think what you identified is that a lot of times the news they'll be hearing back might not be news they want to hear. I think that's significant in a lot of cases. But I also think that where we have seen that sort of catalog kept and I think been quite useful for the access community is the Sunshine Government Initiative has this spreadsheet of, it's in the hundreds now, but of stories that were done on the back of FOIA and that they take around with them when they lobby on the Hill, you know, saying here's a reason why you need to support FOIA. And the congressman can look down and say, this was a big story in my district, I remember it, I got a lot of calls about it. So
I think the idea of using feedback from the public to help you do your job is a great idea, but in addition to the use made of the value sets, I would add another possibility. Drawing on my many years of experience in congressional oversight, specifically of how agencies like, let's say, the FBI operates under guidelines that are supposed to limit its collection of information about Americans, which you read about all the time. At the end of the day, the only way that oversight, part of your responsibilities, can really be done is to look on a spot basis at cases and see how the agency looked at the guidelines, what paper there was, what information they had, et cetera. And either you decide that they did everything right, but maybe the guidelines have to be changed because doing everything right doesn't give you the right result, or you might find that they didn't obey the guidelines and someone has to talk to them. Well, similarly, with regard to FOIA, I suggest that if you met regularly with some of the practitioners that were here today and others, or the ACLU on some other areas like state secrets, and listen to some of the anecdotes, and then go in and look at, from the government side, what was the analysis done by the FOIA people. You might find in some cases that the FOIA statute or guidelines have to be changed, and you might find in other cases that they're still, despite all the training, not following them, and be able to exercise the proper oversight.
I have one last question for the panel. For many of us that have been dealing with public access, the holy grail was to move from the file a FOIA request agency response model to a presumption of openness where there was an affirmative dissemination model of agencies putting information out. I think most of us in this room probably would love to see that day occur. I guess the question I have for the panel is, does the Open Government Directive move us any closer to that end game, and what needs to be done to get us closer within the Open Government Directive if you think it is on the right direction? So I'll let you, anybody who would like to quickly try and respond, and let you each take a shot at it.
I'll respond quickly. I think it does move us further down the line. I think it puts a lot of responsibility in the agencies to act proactively, to start putting up the, I mean, it has the Friday deadline of the first three, but as Alex said, you know, that's a down payment. We're going to see more data sets coming out. There's going to be an interaction with the public to say, what do you need, and start getting it to them without the, what Clint was talking about the formal FOIA process of filling out a very legalistic letter and sending it in and waiting 20 days. It's hopefully going to break that down to where the agencies are listening more and able to engage in a candid dialogue and be more open without having an adversarial process to get us there.
Else might take a crack or not?
I think it moves us definitely, and there's great potential. And I think it gives particularly the public and the NGOs a hook, a template to watch what happens.
So we, from your point of view, the public has to use those hooks in some concrete way.
Yeah. Use it or lose it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I don't see how you can debate that it moves in that direction. I mean, there's no, we'll see what all these high-value data sets are come Friday, but that will be 60, 20 agencies times three, 60 less FOIA requests that people have to do. And if they're, I'm serious, and if they're really high value, then hopefully it will be many more than 60 again and again. And that's just the crack in the door. I think, you know, it's hard to see a model where every document produced by every desk in government is online before you ask. But I don't think it's hard to see how that can be done with the data that is regularly being collected and kept in electronic databases inside government. It's just a matter of moving it. That's more complicated, but.
Alex, do you want to have the last word on it?
Yeah, just I would generally agree with what has just been said. I think the directive directionally moves in the direction Gary wants to see. There is this effort to shift the presumption to disclosure if there's no legal or policy reason for withholding, you know, based on Homeland Security concerns or avoiding invasions of personal privacy. There is a lot of data that can be affirmatively pushed out that does not need to be requested through FOIA. And I think maybe in a year we'll have some experience and we'll see what has been disclosed and take stock at that point.
So as I hear it, Dan, the charge is to convene us a year from now to talk about whether the OGD is working.
I think that makes a lot of sense, Gary. And speaking of feedback, I want to give you as our moderator and this panel feedback right away, saying you've done a terrific job at holding the interest of so many people so late in the afternoon. So please join me, folks, in thanking this year the panel. And just to pick up on what Gary said, yes, as I mentioned this morning, we are aiming to convene again on Thursday, January 20th, 2011, to advance this forward. And I would hope that people inside the administration, not you in particular, Alex, but others perhaps, will be mindful of that we'll be looking at things both generally and in particular at that time. And I want to just mention one more thing with respect to the scorecard. It's no longer up on the screen, but we had an update during the day, an updated printout of the CGS, both the transparency in the Obama administration and the scorecard portions of our website. And many of you, I think, may not have seen that on the way in, so please check for what looks like this. It says transparency in the Obama administration as a pile of handouts on your way out. That's not your only reward for staying so late, however. And the other part of that is that we do have a reception at which you have an opportunity to ask tough questions of our panelists even more and our former panelists during the day. We'll be adjoining right now to what we call the foyer, right outside where there are drinks and refreshments. And again, thank you everyone for your kind attention all day long today.